David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 452. I'm your host, Steve Raker, down in the comic book bunker, protecting the nexus of all realities that lies here in secret, as is my task and curse. With me fighting the good fight are my co-hosts, Andrew the L.A. Rabbit, the linchpin of the latest West Coast Avengers revival, and WW Whirlwind X Kevin, whose collection of cosmic cube shards and scattered Norn stones basically makes him the king of Canada anytime he decides to be.
Wow, how about that?
Does that make me like Jennifer Hale or something, Steve?
If the man thing was involved.
Well, you're at the Nexus and everything.
Marvel Noise is the Marvel-centric semi-monthly podcast that is proudly sponsored by nobody. But we wouldn't, this year podcast wouldn't be possible without the heroics of Dangerous Derek Coward and his Deliberate Noise Network, where you can find other fine podcasts, including Indie Comic Book Noise, our sister show where Andrew plays ringleader to Kevin, Phil, and sometimes me, and we talk indie comics.
I don't know if I'm really the ringleader, but check it out if you like indie books.
Any items?
I know you wear that top hat.
Any items for the bullpen bulletins page here, guys? Or should we get right into it?
We need to get I'm going to tease a shocking revelation by the end of this segment.
All right. Then let's get right
into it. You own one of these issues? No, that's not shocking.
6 years ago, back on Marvel Noise episode 327, from March of 2019... Andrew, Kevin, and I covered the first 7 early solo Human Torch stories, and I'm talking Silver Age, not the original Torch and Toro stuff, from Strange Tales 101 to 107 from 1962 into 1963, where the Torch took on the Wizard, a warlord from the Fifth Dimension, Acrobat, the Submariner, and of course, Taste Pot Pete.
Which begs the question, when are we covering those Human Torch and Toro stories?
It's taken us a while, but 6 years? But it's time for another batch, beginning with Strange Tales 108. And these are
I get 2 memories from seeing this cover.
It's a great cover with the Fantastic Four coming after the Torch by Kirby and Ayers. And you can believe, true believer, that this was the only use of the waving Human Torch cornerbacks. Don't know why that didn't catch on.
Yeah.
These books, too, they're all on the Marvel Unlimited digital service, and they are collected quite handsomely in the Human Torch and Thing Strange Tales Complete Collection trade paperback from a few years ago.
It's strange as on the Unlimited that they a lot of times only do the half book because they don't have the other one. So you just get the Torch until we get to the other more famous co-sharer of this book.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping we continue this segment because I actually have the Marvel Masterworks Volume 2 for the Human Torch, but that starts at 118. So get to it now. Yeah.
Yeah, this was an anthology book before the Torch and during these early Torch tales. This wasn't like a split book like Iron Man and Captain America, that kind of thing. So you got a Human Torch story and usually an old reprint and then maybe another original or 2 reprints. But it was the nature of the anthology book from the Silver Age, basically. And here, too, the splash pages were like second covers, you know, like it wasn't until issue 112 that they start being the first panels of the story. But before then, you get the Torch cover, and then you get like a second version of a cover image as the splash page to, I guess, differentiate it from the other anthology tales. Here the Torch is showing.
Tell me why I see this cover to the first issue here, and then I'm thinking of Parafino, the guy from the Spider-Man cartoon.
Well, he has that kind of old-timey artist guy, but I was trying to, I remember him from the cartoon, but I was like, was he ever in the comic books or cartoon only? But it's a nice splash, but it's like the edge of the canvas, I feel like. I don't know how he's standing. It's kind of, I thought it would be the other way, but I guess he's kind of standing to the side. Anyways, it's just one of those ones that you stare at, and it looks cool, but my brain was trying to figure out the perspective a little bit.
These stories were all plotted by Stan Lee, but he, at this time, on this title, had a couple of different guys scripting for him. And on this story, it was Ron Bernstein, and the art was by Jack Kirby and Dick Ayers. The Torch is shown working with police on case after case, really making a dent in organized crime. He's like melting the road into bubbling lava without a care for the delivery trucks or rural commuters. And the mob hires a painter who can bring his illustrations to life to take the Torch down. And you guys thought of the cartoon. I was thinking of my childhood and the I know you, I know my name is Simon, and the things I draw come true. Did you remember that guy, Andrew, or are you that much younger?
No, I don't. Well, we only had a few TV stations, so I watched a disturbing amount of Canadian television. Hence the Friendliest Giant and all that stuff.
This painter who can bring his illustrations to life, he's got an imagination like Kirby. It's like three-headed, six-armed gorilla things and giant crazy cannons and stuff.
He certainly is fast as Kirby, that's for sure.
You're telling me this guy doesn't turn into bugs or anything like that guy in Web of Spider-Man?
It definitely feels very post-code, though, with the way the the way the Torch and the cops and everything. It does feel very like the long arm of the law will always win.
And their uniform will always be pressed.
Yeah, it feels very like this is of a time when we're not going to have any of those. Take your EC comics and stuff them.
So how does the painter do it? Well, when he was tunneling his way out of prison, like with a spoon or something.
Like you do.
He found a secret cavern with ancient Egyptian-like hieroglyphics that were really alien in origin. And this is like in New York, right? And contained within the secret messages were the formula for alien paints that would allow him to do this. So there you go.
Alien paints.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit of cadmium yellow.
And he's forced to be reckoned with. Ross.
A little bit of asbestos there.
The painter stymies Torch while the bad guys, the mobsters, pull off the heists. He uses a giant hydrants to douse him. A goggle of Kaiju lead the Torch out to the beach for a sandblasting. And then the final trap is an attack by the rest of the Fantastic Four. But the Torch that they attack was a copy himself that the Torch had printed or had painted and then, you know, had come to life. But can he make flame duplicates of himself?
He can, but that uses up. This is that great era where every superhero had to have some obvious weakness so they could always plot the story. And remember, this is where he always runs out of fire, so he has to conserve, so you always just want him to run down his fire so he doesn't have enough. But right. These stories, the Human Torch has a million skills that are pretty I feel from this time period, look, you were either a Spider-Man guy or a Human Torch guy, and we all know what side of the fence I'm on. So the arrogance of the Torch is a little bit much at times.
Well, speaking of, the issue ends with the painter's attention to detail in his art being totally dressed down by the Torch. Like, everybody's a critic.
Oh, hey, forgot the Torch this. Painted himself.
You missed that. Himself. You forgot that. You there were no people on the beach. There were no fours on the Fantastic Four's chest. He's like, you know, the guy's like, oh, man.
That guy had six fingers.
I can't be the only guy that went back and noticed you couldn't see the fours because every time it was shown, it was obscured. And I'm like, well, that's kind of a cheat. And he points out something that the reader can't. Because it was like those goofy mystery comics, Steve. Remember, you used to... stare at the solution to
you
this.
Go back. Is in the sure. Page. I thought there was one panel that I could see. It's not on Mr. Fantastic's chest, though.
It looked to me like it was all, like their arms are kind of covered. And I'm like, well, I don't really know that that's, what am I going to.
Issue 109 from March of 1963 also has a Kirby Ayers cover. Now, this one looks like an issue of Strange Tales. It's like kooky Kirby monsters. Written by Lee and Bernstein with art by Kirby and Ayers.
This one felt very similar to the last one, although I feel like the Torch is kind of to blame. He's a real jerk in this one and pushes the action. He's the one that causes the situation to escalate.
Yeah. So the Torch has an encounter with this old hermit who is chasing kids off his lawn, basically. But the guy's a sorcerer, kind of. And I mean, even though it's taken a lifetime of study and he's got the ancient Pandora's box and he's going to open it, but at this time where he's like close to opening it and getting to the end of his long path where he'll be, as he says, rich and powerful, and his name will go down in history as the most feared man who ever lived, he does a quick 180 and his motivations change. And all of a sudden now the goal is, above all, I'll get even with the teenage meddler, the Torch. See, for a thousandfold for humiliating me today. It's like, reminds me of the old Simpsons bit where Homer goes to buy a gun and he's got like a 3-day wait. And he's like, but I'm mad now. This guy's had this lifetime to decide what he's going to do with these ancient magic when he has them and rule the world and everything. And it's like, well, wait a minute, stop on a dime. No, above all else, I'm going to get back on this. You know, bothered me this morning. It's back to the kids on the lawn for this guy, basically.
I knew something was up when this guy had three dogs on the leashes there. Like, that's suspicious.
Yeah. That's crowd control when you have a third dog.
They also really stretch. It's the Pandora's box. And so, like, we all have our vision, but when he releases, like, paralysis and forgetfulness, and I didn't really consider those the evils of the ancient world.
But it's kind of fun that the different sprites that come out of it each have like a different property, right? I mean, I thought that was a fun gag.
The gag was fun, but I thought it's pretty lazy to require. Speaking of releasing the imp of laziness, that's what they did here. I mean, how is paralysis an evil of the ancient world, Steve?
Hey, you accidentally get botulism and see how much fun it is. You suck the Ferrari and get buried alive with the, Pharaoh. See how much you like it. Well, interesting, though, when they go back and show the origin of Pandora's box, who is putting the evils into Pandora's box is Circe, spelt with C's, but in Jack Kirby's Eternals number 3 in 1976, it gets retconned that this is in fact Circe from the Eternals who did this act. So this is the first appearance of Circe in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, I don't know if that's officially recognized, Steve.
Well, it's time for Kevin to run out and start getting some first appearance.
Again, Jack's writing gets no love.
I thought that was a clever hook of the Eternals to have them real and like their names and their deeds get slightly misremembered, as would happen any kind of oral tradition passing it down. I thought that was a really clever story hook.
Eventually, the torch tricks the sorcerer into releasing an imp of fire that then he can absorb and like supercharge himself up and defeat him. Throughout in this issue and throughout this series, Johnny mentions Glenville, the town on Long Island where he and Sue were raised and lived together before Sue and he moved into the Baxter Building. We're still only in, you know, around issue like 15 or 16 of the Fantastic Four at this time. And Johnny attends high school in Glenville and stuff. And it's funny because there is a Glenville, New York, but it's not on Long Island. It's 3.5 hours north in upstate New York, near me, just north of Schenectady in the Capital Region.
Hmm. Well, fun fact. High city area, Steve.
And Johnny throws Pandora's box into the ocean at the end of the issue, and it stays there until 1969, where it next appears in the Chamber of Darkness series, number 3. Another fun fact for you.
Not the Chamber of Chills.
Right. No, I know. I even wrote Chamber of Chills when I first wrote it down, and I was like, oh, I had to scratch that out. I wrote Darkness. Chills was in the 70s.
And Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets.
Chilly in the 70s, so.
Issue 110 from April 1963 has a Jack Kirby Dick Ayers cover where the Wizard and Pastepot Pete have teamed up against the Torch, and the Wizard is telling Pete to finish him off with his invincible Pastepot gun. And I'm thinking invincible with its unsealed cap and long, vulnerable hose.
This one. That was years ago with some friends, and they're like, man, that's an expensive issue. And I was like,
yeah,
it's got Pastepot Pete on the cover. I mean, he quickly discovered it was for the Doctor Strange first appearance, but for a while I had him going with the, well, you know, Pastepot Pete on the cover raises the price of your comic.
The second feature in this is the start of the Doctor Strange serial.
And I thought, Dick Ayers really jumps up a little bit in this one. I thought this one was a slicker, better looking issue without, I mean, having to work off of the Kirby thumbnails. For me, this worked a little bit better. Dick Ayers' nice faces and stuff.
It's Dick Ayers' pencils and inks, and written by Stan Lee with scripts by H.E. Huntley going as Ernie Hart.
He doesn't.
Vice versa. Going as H.E. Huntley.
Doesn't make the Wizard look quite ugly enough, though. The Kirby specialty.
Agreed. You know, it looks really Ayers has faces. That Wally Wood, you know, cleanness of some of his faces. They have good structure to them, and they seem, you know, like they have mass to them, and they look different than each other, but they're nice and clean, almost handsome.
Yeah, this was one where I was like, how are they going to resolve? I was reading a lot of modern comics, and so much happens in this. I'm like, this would be like a 12-issue series.
For sure.
They start out with like extensive clip show, and then they have to team up, and then they get one over, and then he gets, like, it's, there's a lot that goes on. And I kept being like, wow, is this a two-parter or something?
Pastepot Pete breaks the Wizard out of jail, and they become the Frightful Two. They just don't know it yet.
Ooh.
And, you know, he totally does his homework, right? He's like spying on the prison and learning all the routines and stuff. And this is binoculars made with powerful lenses fashioned of clear paste, Andrew.
I like Pastepot Pete's in the rich tradition of 60s Marvel villains, like Doc Ock, got a bit of a belly on him. You know, we're not the 90s where these guys are all rippling muscle on top of impossible muscle. These are guys that like a good meal and sitting around watching TV.
I don't know. Have you seen Doc Ock in the 90s?
The pace can make a gag. It could make ropes. He can use reverse suction on his paste gun to fry the prison bars from their housings.
Would you rather have that as a backpack, though?
He's the guy. Well, he's going to get his classic redesign pretty soon. When the painter looks all right, but he really steps into his own.
When the wizard and Pastepot Pete are escaping the prison in a truck together, they are already plotting that they're going to be unstoppable. If they just defeat the torch, their criminal careers will just skyrocket. And the wizard, having had all of this time incarcerated to decide what he's going to do next, says, "Our headquarters will be my house. This will never dream I'd go there."
So he has the classic Kang seated pose. Every time I see that pose of someone like partially reclined, I think of Kang.
Are they sitting on paste furniture? Is that what's
going on? Yeah, why not?
He'll never look for him at home. He's not at prison where he's supposed to be. The last place we would check is his. I don't know if I'm buying that logic. And so the wizard decides he's going to make an asbestos suit. Won't be the first time we'll hear that trick used. And he's going to impersonate the torch and, make life miserable for the torch and draw him out or whatever. And so the torch ends up chasing them, but it's a trap. And they get him in the cover scenario of the mirrored cell. And fire extinguishers are going to extinguish the torch for good. But, and we'll see this theme used over and over again. Floor, Andrew. They didn't fireproof the floor. So he burns his way out that way.
Well, I thought there's a bit of wisdom that all of us reading these comics always have to think when Pete and the wizard are sniping each other and Pete retorts at one point, "Do you always have to make a speech when you do something?" Exactly, Pete.
I love when bad guys bicker. That never gets old. Like, bad guys bickering is just one of those fun things about comic books. And, how about when the wizard is plotting that he's going to do the asbestos suit bit and he's pontificating about that? This, in the panel, there's a little cigarette being held by this little, like, extending arm. Thinking, that's a real level up of the supervillain. Like, everybody else is playing checkers and the wizard's playing chess. You don't need the cigarette holder. Like, he's above the long-handled cigarette holder, and he's got the little accordion arm, long-handled reacher.
Didn't have time, Steve. He's too busy coming up with his ingenious schemes to hold a cigarette back and forth.
Issue 111 also is written by Stan, with scripts by Ernie Hart and art by Dick Ayers. May 1963, with a Kirby Ayers cover. It's the Asbestos Man, the first appearance. And I guess I can fathom where they got the idea for the Asbestos Man from the month before when the wizard put on the asbestos suit. I was like, hey, wait a minute, that was too quick as the torch. What if he put it on as a way to defend himself against the torch? And that's what we get. Professor Orson Asloff is a genius, and he knows he would make a fortune in the criminal world if only he knew some criminals.
Oh, that's all it takes.
He tries to go it alone, but he's really not cut out for the field, as they say.
Oh, he wants to be a henchman, I guess.
I love the opening splash where the guy has the old-timey camera. The giant huge one that you're like, I don't think Peter's got his little micro cannon or whatever that he runs around with, and this guy's got the old giant flash bulbs going off.
Professor Kasloff decides that taking down the torch will be his ticket to coolness in the underworld. So towards those ends, he buys an abandoned mansion, develops an asbestos arm, and sends Johnny some fan mail. Meet me and fight me or die. And here's my address. The Torch shows up and he's easily bested, trapped, and released like a fish. So for round two, the Torch wises up and he melts whatever isn't asbestos, including the floor. It's always the floor. And
only they would have thought of that.
Yeah, you know, well, you know, 10 years later, the floor would have been made of asbestos tiles, and that trick wouldn't be possible. But at this time, it just melts the linoleum. And as you're thinking, geez, suit of asbestos, that's probably not a good idea. Sure enough, Professor Orson Kazaloff would appear again in 2014 in James Robinson and Leonard Kirk's Fantastic Four number one, where, yes, you guessed it, he'd die of cancer.
There we go.
Yeah,
I'm just waiting for that.
Yep.
Years ago, my old man got so excited when he found a bunch of asbestos tiles and I used them. He was like, oh, I'm taking those back and putting them in the barn.
Wow.
My grandmother had open heart surgery like in her 30s, in the early 70s, and they packed the wound with asbestos. Her heart, they like put asbestos in there to like, you know, oh, makes a great, you know, great insulator. They used to use it as for surgical purposes. It's crazy. Anyway,
people love asbestos, Steve. You gotta give the people what they want. What they want is fireproof stuff. But the other thing I like is, so this guy beats a Torch and lets him go, and the Torch burns up all the oxygen and threatens to basically murder him.
He
doesn't surrender. I'm like,
no.
Well, I guess the lesson is don't be nice to the Torch.
Yeah, he's not going to return the favor. Because the deal was just to best the Torch so he could get some cred, right? And join the underworld. And he did. He was done with the Torch. He, as far as he was concerned, he never wanted to see the Torch again. But nope. Issue 112 from June 1963 also has a Kirby Ayers cover, and it is written by Lee and Joe Carter with art by Dick Ayers. It's the threat of the living bomb, it says on the cover and on the splash page, which really makes this guy sound tough. He must be called the living bomb, but he's not. Instead, it's the first appearance of the eel.
Whoa. How about that? I thought maybe it was one of those issues where the Beyonder shows up and turns something into gold.
Like peanut butter on jelly on gold. So the story starts off with a Torch. He loves showing off, but there's this radio commentator who has his number and he's critical editorials and stuff. So then you've also got the eel being introduced, and he steals something, but he doesn't know what it is. He opens it up, and it must be important because it's like was like locked up and everything. And yeah, it's like basically a bomb. And if you open it, the clock is unpredictably ticking now. That makes him the living bomb. It's not a good thing. It's not like from a position of power that he's the living bomb. It's not. Oh, it's a Batman running down the pier.
Not the living bomb burst, Steve. Yeah. This is the first draft.
It's just not the way the cover made it seem like it was going to be.
Yeah, it's a totally different story.
So the Torch searches for the eel, but only finds the thing. No, wait, there he is. There's the eel. They tussle. The Torch takes the bomb, flies high, and boom. It's not a good look. The world waits patiently while Mr. Fantastic uses some doohickey machines to revive Johnny. And ironically, it's the dude who is critical of him on the radio that now sees him as a hero and gets to report on his recovery, which is hilarious. He's given the recovery and they show like the scene on the streets of everyone like going nuts, like turning over police cars and stuff.
It was a simpler time. Simpler times, Steve.
Except for the, like, is that MODOK? Before he became MODOK there, there's this giant head with a leg coming out on the Yippie panel. That is hilarious. All right. Then Also in June 1963, the Strange Tales Annual came out for that year. Issue 2 of the Strange Tales Annuals. And this featured a full-length 18-page masterpiece written by Stan Lee with pencils by Jack Kirby and inks by Steve Ditko. Plus
yeah,
10,
I think this looks
10
good
reprint
together.
Stores.
Yeah, that's a combo.
There's
I mean, on the limited, they just have the new story. They don't have all the reprints.
No, you don't want the 10 reprints. But it's got a Kirby Sol Brodsky cover, and Sol usually basically traced Kirby. But
yeah, that Spider-Man looks weird.
Well, it's the classically represents how, I mean, it showcases how weird Kirby always did Spider-Man's webs on his costume. And the spider's missing on his chest.
Yeah, and it's like, did he gain a few pounds? Like, I'm trying to figure out this. Are the costumes, like, fitting weirdly? It's just, I don't know.
He's Spider-Man in this one, Kevin, not Spider-Boy. Mm-hmm. So,
look, Kirby always made him bulky, especially in the shoulders and, you know, in the abs.
Or maybe he looks like Spider-Teen.
We've seen that when the issue opens, we've seen the Torch doing his training sessions that are run by his sister, Sue. But this one might be the coolest. If the Kirby-esque design of the wheel he's spinning in the one panel that he's flying around is so cool. And then, like you referred to earlier, Andrew, the weird use of his flame to shape it like a key to pick a lock is so Silver Age. It makes me smile.
Also, there's no way I can figure out how that device turns, period. You know? it's like she's holding onto a spoke of it. It's crazy. But, I mean, that's what you want, is the crazy, like, it's cool, they're training. Like, you got to have that. And what do you want them, like, lifting weights or something? That's boring.
It's like she's spinning the Price is Right wheel. It's like she's really leaning into it. It's got to go all the way around at least once. Or else you got to do it over. So the Torch is super jealous of Spider-Man, who gets all the fame for himself while the Torch is stuck playing a bit part on a team. Ooh-hoo. If only he had
I guess he doesn't read the Daily Bugle.
Well, it's just the Daily Bugle. Everybody else loves Spidey. The Daily Globe, oh, for Pete's sake, they love him. But if only the Torch had a chance to take him down several notches, he would. And he gets his chance. When the Fox frames Spider-Man for a series of burglaries, and before Kevin gets excited, no, it's not the Fox from the 80s and beyond. This guy has a long nose and red hair and pointy ears, maybe.
Yeah, there's no way this guy's still alive by the 80s either. He looks like he's in his late 70s and smokes pretty heavy, so.
Spidey heads to Glenville to find the Torch, explain his innocence, and team up to find those responsible. He figures the Torch is a teenager too. What could go wrong, right? Well, the police could ask Johnny for his help apprehending Spider-Man moments before Spidey knocks on his window, so there's that. And they tussle.
He's a menace.
There's pool-soaked webbing involved. There's fiery duplicates. I love the fiery duplicates. And Andrew, there's Spidey speed. I didn't know about the Spidey speed, but he's like running around serpentine around the trees like Quicksilver.
Best is that this issue has their fights last more than the work to capture the bad guys.
Well, that's what you want to see, isn't it? That's what you want to see. Kirby and Ditko working together on their creations. And you know, there's this one cool panel right before Spidey retreats where they're looking down. It's a down building shot from the sky and the Human Torch is on the sidewalk and Spidey is upside down on the building. And you're looking at the soles of his feet up the back of his legs. And it's not a gratuitous butt shot because of how the shadowing is. And his arms are in like a push-up position. It's such a cool looking panel. I'm like, Kirby and Ditko really doing some fine
stuff.
Need more
of that.
Yeah, right? So Spidey retreats and mixes up some really strong fireproof webbing. Then he seeks out the torch, starts a chase, and in a really fun sequence, he catches him in a web. I thought that was really cool. Spidey pleads his case in disgust at the torch's behavior and splits. When the torch is free, he learns that there was another robbery while they were fighting, so it couldn't be Spider-Man. He must have been
like how he doesn't listen to reason because he's an idiot and a jerk. So even though Spider-Man points out all the things he could have done to him, and he just wanted to talk, the torch won't believe it until he has some weird evidence, even though he found plenty of evidence before.
Listen, the torch has been let free before. He's been captured and beaten and just let go before. So, I guess he's wary of that move. That's his
appetite for violence.
He's extra cautious. He's extra cautious when they don't do anything to him after they capture him. So the torch leaves Spidey a flaming message in the sky for the first of what would be many, many times over the next more than 60 years that Spider-Man and the Human Torch would meet atop the Statue of Liberty. Really cool. So in disguise, the Fox attacks Spidey in a subway station and flees with Spidey and the Torch in pursuit. And there's a really cool close-up panel of Spider-Man hugging the rails as a train passes over him. And you can feel the crowded, tight space of that panel. It's a good one.
Yeah, I like how he's crouched down there. You know, I've never been to the Statue of Liberty.
No? When I went, we weren't allowed to go into the statue part itself because they were working on it. Like, must have been in the late 70s. And we just were able to go up to the top of the pedestal, but that seemed really way high up there.
Yeah, so you weren't able to go on top of her head, Steve, and meet Spider-Man or the Human Torch?
So Spidey and the Torch use Spidey's spider sense to uncover and ransack several of the Fox's hidden lairs, and they finally encounter him, again in disguise, outside the last one in Central Park. The Fox tries to flee with rocket-powered skates on his shoes, but, as established earlier, as all good stories do, spider speed. He can't outrun Spider-Man with the spider speed. He's like, bing, 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 ricochet rabbit, and he's coming right after him.
Well, when you think of a spider, don't you think of their speed? Because they have all those legs?
Yeah, I mean, they can run faster than a speeding bullet, right?
Fun annual.
Yeah, I wish I had the I didn't know any of the reprints, though, is the only downside of this. And this is coming out. Oh, I guess this was right after Iron Man. I was like, boy, wonder who had the rocket powered roller skates first, the Fox or Iron Man.
Issue 113 of Strange Tales hit the stands in July 1963, written by Stan Lee and Joe Carter with Dick Ayers art again with a Kirby, Brodsky, and Don Heck cover. And this one has the first appearance of Doris Evans, who the Torch would date all the way through the rest of his Strange Tales run and that would go to issue 133, and they'd eventually break up in Fantastic Four 45 in September 1965. She's not
Is this
so...
also sort of a Thunderbolt segment?
She's not so hot on the Torch, but she likes Johnny. And he's like, oh man, if this Slowpoke wasn't so doggone pretty.
I like how she takes the wind out of his sails, arrogant little so-and-so.
Well, the circumstance of this issue are that Dory's father fires their gardener because he thinks he can talk to the plants with some handheld device that he's got. Later, during a time where he's testing it at home in his own greenhouse, lightning strikes the device, and now it really works, Kevin. Add a green trench coat and a hat, and the Plant Man is born. It's the first appearance of the Plant Man.
I feel like we should have covered this before.
Now we're rooting for the rich guy who fired the poor gardener. Not for cause or anything, because he talks to his plants. And the gardener was right, by the way, so.
Well, the Plant Man easily dispatches the torch when they first meet. You know, wet weeds and dew. What are you going to do? And it kind of goes to his head. He's like, so far, so good. First, I'll conquer New York City, then city after city, and finally the world. And it's like, you know, focus on the first, you know, doable steps, I always say. Achievable steps is the way to go here. Because he figures plants outnumber people by the billions, and I rule the plants. Today, Earth. Tomorrow, the stars. And it's like, again, at least get as far as one city. Let's see how far down that list you get. Round two against the torch, the Plant Man lets loose a leaf storm, falling trees, damp seaweed tendrils, bullet-like acorns being hurled at him, and rains of fruit. But the torch lets loose a giant fireball that dries out all the plants and turns them on their master. Okay.
Like how he insults the plants. They're kind of like plants. You know, they're not, but really feels like this should have been an Ant-Man villain. Ants versus plants.
Ooh, that'd been cool. You know, the Plant Man's origin would be retconned a little and expanded upon by John Byrne in 1992's Namor the Submariner 24, where they add that his gun was souped up by the Hilrithi, that plant-like alien race that was involved with the whole Iron Fist death and everything. Makes sense more than just the lightning.
Yeah, I mean, that's how origins were, right? Maybe you get some hard water fumes. Maybe you get some lightning.
Leave it to Burn to try to flesh it out a little more.
But I'm not offended by those other dudes getting involved in the origins. So, you know.
Well, are you guys ready for my bombshell reveal?
Is it time?
May shock you. It's time. You know, I look these things up and we're at that point, as Steve's pointed out, that a lot of guys have to work under fake names because DC are a bunch of jerks. So the internet would have me believe, do you know who went under the pen name Joe Carter? It was Jerry Siegel of Superman fame. Yep. And I realized after reading these, I now think I've read more Jerry Siegel Human Torch stories than Jerry Siegel Superman stories.
Wow, how about that?
Which is kind of crazy because I realized, like, I'd read at all the Golden Age DC stuff, probably Wonder Woman and Batman far outnumber, but I was like, you know what? I don't think I've read that much Siegel and Schuster Superman. I mean, the first Action Comics reprint, sure, but
right.
I don't know that I've read any of those other, like, it was just one of those realizations where you're like, whoa, because all the, even by the time I was reading, if there were collections of greatest Superman stories, it wasn't chock full of that stuff. You know, they'd have the first one and then they'd jump to, you know, whatever stuff from Kurt Swan or whatever, yeah. You know.
Wild City of Kandor.
Yeah, so I was like, whoa, I wonder if I'm missing out on all those old Superman stories or not. But as you guys know, I'm a big Golden Age guy. But anyways, that was my shocking reveal. I read more of the Superman guy's Human Torch stories in all likelihood.
That's pretty
good. And if there's any Superman stories I should read by Siegel and Schuster.
Hmm.
Yeah.
You're a big DC guy.
Oh, you mean you, right? You that bring up that DC on every indie, but I'm the... Okay.
What do
I
you
don't say? Know, like... I don't really know how many stories he's really been involved in. Like, I know some of the classic covers, and everything like that, but I don't. Well, that it's was sort me. Of like, you know, when you first start reading and you're like, oh, I don't know who the creator is. Like, I don't really don't know who it did any of that stuff, but I know some of those covers is like there's a giant piece of machinery or whatever, or there's a train, you know, a lot of classic stuff, iconic stuff, but I don't think I've read any of that stuff.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? But we've all read like the old, you know, first appearance of Joker and stuff like that, and the way back when Batman had machine guns and stuff like that.
Purple gloves.
It's the stuff that they chose to reprint. And when we were kids, they were having, you know, Neil Adams was starting to push for the Siegel-Schuster law stuff. And so I don't think we were getting exposed to a lot of that stuff where Kane had already made his deal.
Yeah, it was just one of those blind spots. I mean, all of Golden Ages, but it was just funny, I thought. And didn't know if you guys had any big Siegel and Schuster Supermans that people should be.
No, I've read more Schuster Smut because of the Craig Yeo book than actual Superman stories.
I'm probably based on these stories. Probably would like the artwork more than the writing. Not there's anything wrong with those,
but those original old Filmation Superman serials, those really old cartoons, those were like
the Fleischers,
Those look like Joe Schuster art.
I thought I like those, and I think fell through because they used to be in every drugstore for like a dollar or whatever you buy the. Because there's only only a few of maybe 12 or something have survived. But yeah, I used to really like those. I mean, the World War II ones are a little bit dicey, but you know, you get what you can when, you know, sometimes they do not great portrayals of people when you're in war. But other than that, yeah.
All right, let's hit the last couple here for this episode. And I've been waiting to get to this one. It's issue 114 of Strange Tales from August 1963, written by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, with art by Kirby and Ayers. It's a Kirby Ayers cover with Captain America. Wait, what? Avengers 4.
Real Captain America?
Avengers 4 is hit the stands January 1964 and is cover dated a few months after that. So it hasn't happened yet. This is August 1963. It's the first appearance of Captain America in the Marvel Universe and the first appearance of Captain America since the Golden Age.
Did they want to bring him back?
This is the crazy one, Kevin, that kills zombies.
That was the end of the Golden Age. So the Torch stops some gangsters at an auto show. Despite Captain America's interference, and Cap gets the credit. Now, they've got Cap correctly with the blue shorts on the cover, but they've got him red on the inside, which is a little weird looking.
Yeah, but it doesn't work for me.
It's off-putting.
Real wear, yeah.
And they hadn't really, I mean, you know, Stan and Jack hadn't really decided if they wanted Cap to be a real person in the Marvel Universe or not, because they have Sue referring to him as that old comic book character, which I thought was interesting. He is referred to as if he was you would think he was a fictional character rather than someone who, you know, made the newsreels and that kind of thing.
Will you make more allusions to the Flash here?
Which seems kind of weird considering they did the whole Namor thing.
Yeah.
Or, you know, odd that they'd be like running away from. Well, but hey, there was a lot of, it's not like Kirby and Simon left under great terms. So that wasn't that long ago. So maybe they're like, let's be careful because we don't want to.
It's a tryout. Someone's probably like, oh, we're bringing back some old character that your father liked.
So Cap helps the bad guys escape prison, then gets caught by the Torch pulling off a bank heist.
Oh, Cosmic Cube?
El Hydra.
Yeah, exactly.
Cap leads the Torch on a great chase And my favorite move is him using a wet mop as an arrow. And the superintendent of the building having to help use a whole bunch of like plug in electric heaters to pry the torch off. The torch finally chases Cap down and confronts him again. This time he traps him in a flame cage and unmasks him. And it's the Acrobat from Strange Tales 106 who is masquerading as Cap. My favorite move in the book is a panel when he's chasing the crooks that escaped from prison with Cap's help, and he forces their car off a cliff by lassoing with a flame lasso their tires right off, so their car just goes flying off the road and presumably to their death.
Yeah, the amount of violence in that collision, but it's well represented. You're right. Like, melts right through, like, you know, a hot knife through butter, like someone might say.
Rubber tires. So in the very last panel of the book, you guessed it, Kevin, it's a tryout. They have Johnny Storm ponder whatever did they have him reading a Captain America comic book and saying, boy, I love Captain America's adventures and how he was Steve Rogers, the private in the army, and then he'd go off and be Cap. And whatever did become of him, is he still alive? Will he ever return? I'd sure like to know. And we get the...
Write in letters, true believer, if you want to see this character again.
Exactly. You guessed it, the editors say. This story was really a test to see if you too would like Captain America to return. As usual, your letters will give us the answer. And what, 4 months later, we'd have... Avengers 4.
I noticed the Human Torch wasn't wondering what happened to Bucky in those old stories. Anytime I can throw dirt on the Human Torch, Steve.
Bucky was alive growing old. Originally. Or not. We'll never know. All right, our last issue is Strange Tales 115 from September 1963, written by Stan Lee and Dick Ayers, with pencils and inks by Dick Ayers, and a cover by Kirby and Ditko, but it's a jam cover with...
Yeah, this looks like a lost Amazing Spider-Man cover.
Well, yeah, it's really nice.
Kirby draws the torch, and... Ditko draws the Sandman and a floating Spidey head. Love Ditko's floating heads.
Yeah, really, really sharp work. Also, as usual, Spider-Man and Ditko have to supply half the Marvel Universe with their characters. So another one of the villains. Although, no. Sand and Fire, I mean, come on, that's a natural connection. And this will be the start of him teaming up with the Wizard and Pace Pop Pete and those are the losers.
Are you really talking about that as opposed to with the Fantastic Four, how many characters they've seeded the Marvel Universe with? I mean, come on.
I say Spider-Man's got that iconic rogues gallery that they had to, he practically, Daredevil has to pay him half his monthly dues, Steve.
Wow. Doesn't FF have the whole concept and locations thing down pat too?
These solo torch stories seeded a lot of villains that would go on in the Marvel Universe. But here we have the Torch versus the Sandman by special arrangement with the Amazing Spider-Man magazine. Wow, I wonder how those negotiations went down.
I don't think all the party were involved.
Yeah.
Dick Ayers, very clean, very nice. It was fun to see, like, obviously I like a Ditko Sandman, but it's fun to see other people take a whack at him.
Oh, that vacuum's in here. You gotta love the vacuum.
We're still at the point where they had to do a lot of clip show action in this story.
And these characters,
and you got to show the defining moment.
Yeah, well, when these characters have only appeared like once or twice before, their whole story is coverable, you know, to this point, so to speak. Well, Reed tells Johnny of an important mission. The Sandman is loose. But it's a total burn because Reed doesn't want Johnny to go after him. He wants him to find Spider-Man to bring him in. But of course, the Torch goes after Sandman. And on the George Washington Bridge, he encounters him, but Sandman easily escapes. The Torch flushes Sandman out by dressing as Spider-Man and issuing challenges through a bullhorn, just like to the heavens.
Exactly how Spider-Man always does it.
Yep.
Listen, we're still in the dumb Sandman phase. We haven't reached his, you know, classy, smart, he's going to make a hero turn version yet.
Well, a great chase ensues through a sprinkler system that partially soaks the Torch and makes the Sandman onto a mud pie. Then they duke it out man to man. And I mean, Sandman's like, are you kidding? Like, I'm almost twice your size. I can handle a dozen squirts like you with my eyes closed. And Johnny's like, oh, that's lucky for you, chum, because I'll be closing them any minute now. I've got one thing in my favor. The long hours the Thing has spent teaching me every rough and tumble trick in the book. And the lessons I've had in judo and karate from Mr. Okay, two things. The thing, and lessons I've had in judo and karate from Mr. Fantastic. You can almost say that's three things because it's judo and karate and the street stuff. But anyway, and who knew Mr. Fantastic was the judo karate guy?
Earlier in this run, the Human Torch casually drops that he's bored. He put up 75 points in his basketball game in high school. Like,
yeah,
that's true. Think he's full of beans, to put it politely, Steve. Well, maybe a little exaggerations here.
Well, maybe it's more than beans. He states here as he lifts the Sandman over his head with ease and pulls him around like a whirlwind, whirling some helpless victim. He says, even with all my flame out, I still have enough excessive heat in my body to more than double my normal strength. You ever hear that one before?
Yeah, I can't tell you how ripped and pumped I feel after coming out of the sauna, Steve.
You don't feel cleansed and everything?
I'm ready to lift serious weights when I'm super hot and dehydrated. But yeah, it was an unsatisfying end, I will say. Like, I feel like they really wimped out on the end. So yeah. We're to believe that the Human Torch is stronger than Spider-Man. Spider-Man always has to trick the Sandman to beat him.
Well, the Spider-Man doesn't have excess human heat in his body or whatever. I mean, well, it is. It's crazy. Johnny kicks his butt. Maybe it's, you know what the difference is? It's the Mr. Fantastic judo lessons. That's what Spidey needs.
Yeah, something tells me Mr. Fantastic can get into some judo poses. Some of us might have a problem.
If you can get him away from his experiment for long enough to show you a few judo throws, that's a win.
Oh, and then you have to get the thing away from holding up some 20-ton gizmo for Reed to work on, too.
Wandering around in the street in a trench coat in the rain.
We're on the Unlimited, so these last few issues afterwards, you go right into that great Doctor Strange stuff. And not to, you know, knock on this stuff, but man, I think that Doctor Strange stuff is really fabulous.
All right. Through these eight issues or so, we had the beginnings of the Frightful Four, a retcon first appearance of the Eternal Circe, the first appearance of the Eel, the first appearance of the Plant Man, the first post-Golden Age appearance of Captain America, the first Spider-Man Human Torch team-up and meeting on the Statue of Liberty, plus Kirby and Ditko collaborations. So that's all fun. All right, thanks, guys. That was fun to go way back to the beginnings of the Marvel Universe and see where some of these characters first originated from and how utterly goofy they were.
Yeah. And we didn't have to travel in a machine with a dog. So, you know.
All right, next episode, we've got a special kind of recent reads roundtable. We've each been tasked to read and share some done-in-one issues. So get your corners and get your cuts taped up and come out fighting.
What do I get for not voting on these things?
There you go.
Voting?
You're the tiebreaker, Andrew.
Yeah.
We need you. All right, until the mole man gets claustrophobic, make mine marble. Later.